proceed with closing arguments. Case number 20-SK-02242, and that's the case of Jolene Malani, petitioner, and Dixie Bailey, respondent. We have everybody appearing remotely, and proceed with closing arguments on behalf of the petitioner. And Mr. McElroy, you can proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thomas McElroy for petitioner. I'm very glad that we were able to take a break before closing, because we heard a lot of evidence yesterday about why Ms. Maloney's concerns were real, why any reasonable person in her situation would have would also be alarmed and concerned, as defined in the statute, which is the statute defines alarm as apprehension or fear resulting from the perception of danger. And we heard a lot of evidence about this yesterday, and I wouldn't want the context to get lost in the context. The context of this case is very concerning in itself. But overnight, for me, the facts, some of the facts came into focus about the contacts that Ms. Bailey had with Ms. Maloney that caused her and would cause any reasonable person fear of harm and cause them alarm. And I don't want to ignore that context, but I do want to focus on the contacts themselves, specifically the first one. Now, the first one, Ms. Bailey came to Ms. Malone's private home, blocked in her driveway, stopped her, verbally accosted her, pointed a gun at her, and this would cause any reasonable person, and did in fact cause my client, substantial concern for her safety. It was shocking. Respondent pointed a pistol and a camera at her phone, at petitioner when she came to petitioner's home on August 25th at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Respondent admitted that she had a pistol on her person at the time she accosted petitioner at her home. At one point, respondent testified that she had a cigar in one hand and a phone in her other. At another point, she testified that she had both hands on her phone the whole time. Her husband testified, inconsistently, that respondent had one hand on her phone and nothing in her other hand. And respondent testified that she had her phone out the whole time, but the only image that she showed the court is the 2 seconds that she was driving away, really after the incident had ended. But the dog that didn't bark is here, is that she supposedly documented the whole incident. And if her testimony is to be believed, her video of this incident and other documentation would be exculpatory for her. Yet all she showed was the footage, those moments after the incident was over. Her statement and her witness's statement are inconsistent. And in this case, the petitioner has the burden of proof by the preponderance of the evidence that the elements of ORS 30.8661 have been met. Petitioner was consistent in her testimony. She was consistent in her testimony of the incident. And she did. Respondent is not to be believed. Here, it's just not credible. Her testimony and the testimony. Her testimony was internally inconsistent. and her witness contradicts her testimony. It is more likely than not that she is not telling the truth about this incident. Now, Ms. Maloney testified consistently about the facts of this incident, and she testified about how afterwards she was alarmed and coerced. She testified about how she immediately called the police and about how she called her friends, and her friends, in fact, came over to be with her, and she was consistent about this. Her witnesses were consistent about this. She testified, and her witness testified consistently about the subsequent drive-by that happened later that night at about midnight. At about midnight, Ms. Maloney came by again and shouted at petitioner, further causing her alarm, further causing her distress. These actions were intended and designed and had the effect that they were intended to alarm and confront and harass petitioner. And it did. Respondent again drove by petitioner's work a week later and slowed down on a busy highway and shouted at petitioner, also causing her alarm. Her witnesses, my client had multiple witnesses that identified respondent, that documented that the contact caused her apprehension and caused her fear and caused her trauma. Now, my counterpart, Mr. Oliveros, went through all of our exhibits again yesterday and trying to change the focus of these exhibits from away from the alarm that petitioner, that respondent, that petitioner felt because of all these contacts from Ms. Bailey's friends, from her cohorts, stemming from Ms. Bailey's actual posts, reshared from Ms. Bailey's posts by, among other people, Mr. Swinney, who his conduct that my client is aware of, knowing further deepens my client's fear and reasonable concern for her safety, as any reasonable person would, seeing that, seeing the spread of hostile contacts, harassment, threats, overt and implied, that Ms. Bailey spawned online. Mr. Oliveros went through those, ignoring the fact that they provide and were offered to show my client's reasonable concern, and instead attacking them as if they were the contacts that we were talking about in the case that give my client and support my client's eligibility for the order in place in this case. Now, the statute is very broad about contacts, and it enumerates 11 different types of activity that constitute contacts, and we are focused on these three specific physical contacts, but we don't focus on them in isolation. Ms. Maloney's limbic system that reacts to the stimulus in the outside world that causes activates people's adrenaline and fear responses are as limited as the statute. But all of this information goes into the objectively reasonable fear my client has. And Ms. Bailey knew what she was doing. She intentionally did these acts. She intentionally spread information online to make my client feel apprehension. She knew it would work, and it did. And she came by my client's house to confront her and accost her, and knew that it would cause her fear, and it did. And she drove by my client's house later that night at midnight, and she knew that it would cause my client or any other reasonable person who had been subjected to the online attacks and the in-person attacks, she knew it would cause them fear. She knew it would cause her fear, and she knows it would cause any reasonable person fear. And she did it anyway. And she did it again on September 2nd when she drove by and yelled at my client in front of her restaurant. Now, my counterpart wants to say, "Hey, girl, I got you, girl. I got you, girl," is not in itself threatening contact. He wants the court to only look at that and disregard the actual physical context of these contacts and the broader physical, the broader online and in-person context of these things. But it doesn't change the fact that my client's testimony about these incidents was consistent. My client's testimony from witnesses was measured, clear, and consistent. It doesn't change the fact that my client testified that she was shaken, that our witnesses testified that she was visibly shaking. It doesn't change the fact that my client testified that she had to greatly increase her anxiety medications that she, as a result of Ms. Bailey's intentional threatening behavior and contacts. My client's case is internally consistent, and respondent's case is not. And by a preponderance of the evidence, I believe we have shown that Ms. Bailey intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly engaged in-person, repeated unwanted contacts with my client. That it's objectively reasonable under that my client, anyone in my client's situation, given the in-person contacts and all of the online threats and contacts, would be alarmed. And in fact, the evidence showed that these repeated unwanted contacts did cause her alarm, did cause her apprehension regarding her safety and safety of her daughter. And the only direct contact my client had was reaching out to respondent saying, "Hey, lay off my daughter. My daughter's off limits." So we have met our statutory burden by a preponderance of the evidence and beyond. Respondent statements and testimony specifically about handling the gun and pointing it at my client on August 25th, 2020. Her statements were internally inconsistent, her testimony was inconsistent with itself, and her witness's testimony contradicts her own testimony. We have met our burden, and I think it's very clear that Ms. Bailey should be restrained indefinitely from having contact with Ms. Maloney. And we ask the court to continue the stalking protective order herein. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Olivera?
Your Honor, good morning. From the evidence, it's clear, Your Honor, that petitioner was coming to this court with unclean hands. But let me explain what I mean. Now, the truth is undisputed. We know, not only from the respondent, but we also know from petitioner that petitioner severed respondent's business. We know from petitioner that she posted respondent's address and in fact posted a map where our respondent resides. We know from petitioner that she published the stalking order for the entire world to see. We know from petitioner that she continued to post throughout. In other words, she never stopped. I think it's clear that these acts suggest her aggressive nature and don't suggest that these acts are from someone who's in fear of responding. Well, I keep in mind that at the time that the petitioner's stalking order was filed, you heard from respondent that she shut down her page. We also know, Your Honor, and it was a claim that petitioner attempted to make over and over that somehow respondent's political views and the actions of third parties in the Proud Boys, somehow those political views and the action of this political group should mean or should be equal to the petitioner being in danger. We also know, Your Honor, that it's fairly clear and it's understood that we have political innocent views and that, in fact, through communications regarding this issue. Petitioners try to sell to Your Honor that our respondent is a Proud Boy and therefore must be or have been planning to get her somehow. Assuming that she might be a member of the Proud Boys, petitioner has proven that that has made her more dangerous. There is an exhibit in this matter that shows respondent with machine gun, but that photograph doesn't suggest one way or another that respondent is going to kill him out and threaten a petitioner in any way. What we do know is that the question of whether or not a respondent made unwanted contacts with a petitioner really requires some notice provision. We know from the testimony of petitioner that respondent that the first event was accidental. It was not planned by anybody. It simply happened. For counsel to take the position that that event was unwanted simply isn't supported by the evidence in this matter. Now, what we recall is that there were only three witnesses. There was petitioner, there was respondent, and there was respondent's husband. What counsel is trying to point out is that the so-called claim of imperfect and inconsistent testimony by respondent and her husband makes all of her testimony fatal with facts. What we know unequivocally is that respondent and her husband made it absolutely clear that that weapon was not used, was not handled at respondent. Counsel didn't even cross Chris Bailey in his examination. So his testimony, Chris Bailey's testimony, comes into the evidence essentially as unrebutted and wasn't impeached. What is troubling with petitioner's testimony is that she didn't act like a person that had a gun pointed at her. By her own statement, what she did is she brought her cell phone to take images from her phone of respondent being near the residence. So what we have from respondent essentially are two exhibits. We have the photograph of truck that respondent was riding in, essentially. So if you look at that from an evidentiary standpoint, it is not who is telling the truth, but we look at it in terms of two witnesses. We only have three witnesses. Petitioner tells her story, responding to her husband, give the court an explanation of what occurred. Was it an unwanted? I don't know. That was never asked of responding in a cross-examination. But it couldn't be unwanted because it was accidental. We heard this guy clearly state that she had no idea that she was going to run into the petitioner at that time. What we don't have in the evidence, and what could have helped investors, petitioner's position regarding the event and the effect on her, is she could have subpoenaed this police officer that she claims she made a report to. Had that officer been subpoenaed, had that officer testified, he would have, on its face, been an unbiased witness regarding to the effect that this had on petitioner. That witness wasn't there. With regard to the second event on that same date, and I'm going to call it the midnight drive-by, Your Honor recalls that there were witnesses on both sides, that one of the employees of petitioner claims that she witnessed and was spotted right by the home, and make some very, very small statement. I think it was a girl. You heard Ms. Bailey testify and this simply never happened. And assuming that it did happen, let's assume that it happened. Where is the alarm? There is an alarm. Recall your eye that the vehicle never stopped and made this innocuous statement, killing girl. It's a stretch for anyone that has any education to take that statement, killing girl, and somehow have that become an alarming statement. And as the court is aware, when it comes to language, well, under Wrangham, I mean, the court's aware, but I want to recite the principles outlined in the manual. And what that court talks about is creating a higher standard based on the words. Quote, to avoid constitutional problems, excessive contacts must meet a more stringent standard than set out in the statute. Randall goes on to say that a more stringent standard requires the contacted person, and in this case the petitioner, to prove that excessive contacts involve threats that, quote, instill any lessee a fear of imminent and serious personal violence from the speaker, an unequivocal or objectively likely to be followed by other lawful acts. How is it that the statement K. Grill meets the standard in Rangel? We know it doesn't. It just simply does not. Event 3, the drive-by, I believe, on September 2nd, after the petition has been filed. We heard responding. She stated that that never happened. There is testimony from a witness that respondent apparently was in a white SUV. You heard from Chris Bailey, respondent's spouse, that they do not own a white SUV. What is noteworthy with respect to her allegation on September 2nd is that if it is true that that occurred, then necessarily that claim would have been a violation of the no contact order. What we know for that is that there hasn't been any court action, there hasn't been police action. The respondent was not interviewed regarding this alleged event that she contends didn't happen. But assuming that it might have happened, would this be unwanted contact? Could this be alarming? Let us suggest by at least the primary witness. And recall, Your Honor, that I asked the witness to estimate how fast this respondent traveled. She reported that she wasn't good at making estimates regarding miles per hour, but suggested that it was less than 45 miles an hour, or maybe 25 miles an hour. But assuming that that's true, that respondent was driving even in lower rate of speed, we're talking about an event that on its best day lasted 10 seconds. Recall that what the petitioner was claiming was that the respondent drove by for a place of business. It didn't take very long. And bring back to what allegedly was said, don't eat here, you'll get sick. That those statements are benign. They don't meet the Rangel standard. Those cannot ever be fine words under any reasonable interpretation of those statements. What petitioner, I believe, was trying to sell the court was somehow these three events have placed her in fear of her safety. We know that even if the court accepts all three of us. What an event that may even break that threshold is this allegation that petitioner pointed a gun at her. At the time of the filing of the petition, it's really questionable whether or not there was unwanted contact or respondent's notice of unwanted contact at the time of the filing. Yes, Raymond is implicated because there are statements of speech allegedly that were made to petitioner. Her belief that somehow she was in danger of responding simply is not objectively reasonable. And the idea that somehow she is in danger of responding is not following evidence in this matter. While we can see that her statements are her statements, simply put, based on the evidence in this matter and based on the case law, this petition for stalking against the respondent should be denied. Thank you, Governor.
All right, thank you, counsel. Rebuttal argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Oliveros' continued reference to the Rangel case is a red herring. It's as if he's trying to convince the court that if Mr. Oliveros came by my house and yelled, "Hey girl, hey," right? That'd be fine. Be weird, but it'd be fine. But that's not the context. Mr. Oliveros didn't come to my house with a gun. Mr. Oliveros didn't threaten to shoot my dogs. Mr. Oliveros didn't get online and dox my daughter. Mr. Oliveros didn't make all the threats and promote all the threats online against me and my safety as Ms. Bailey did to Ms. Maloney. So we have been consistent that it wasn't the speech content. "Hey girl, hey, don't eat at her restaurant, you'll get diarrhea." It wasn't the speech content, it's the context. It's the fact that they come after, they are repeated unwanted contacts that come after a very serious, shocking threat to my client in her home, in her driveway, blocking her in and pointing a gun at her. Now, it defies logic for my counterpart to try and take the position that that contact on August 25th was wanted contact. It was not. My counterpart tries to say that he tries to make the Rangel arguments about the midnight drive-by. He tries to say that they didn't happen, that they were a fabrication. The testimony was consistent about it. And frankly, if we were going to fabricate something, we would have fabricated something better than "Hey girl, hey." It wasn't. That's what she said. That's what she did. And frankly, throughout this case, it's what she did that carries the preponderance of evidence in this case, that carries the day for my client. Except insofar as "I'm going to shoot your dogs," that's a speech act as well that caused her imminent fear. Publishing a stalking order is not signed that my a legal public court order that's already out there is a sign that my client is in fear rather than the opposite. It's a signal to her community that this is the protections out there, it has gone this far, and I need further protection and awareness among my community about this threat. Mr. Alvarez claims that Ms. Bailey shut down her social media accounts and called off the dogs, but he presented zero evidence of it besides the one statement from his client that had done so. Now, this is important exculpatory evidence that if she had called off the dogs, would have been very helpful for Ms. Bailey's side of the case. She didn't do that, and she didn't present that evidence. It's a red herring to say this case is about politics and not about the evidence that we actually put on about the actual threats, about the actual contacts, and about the actual online threats. Finally, Mr. Oliveira says that from an evidentiary standpoint, it's not about who is telling the truth about what happened on August 25th. And I respectfully disagree. It is absolutely about who is telling the truth, whose statements were consistent, who's consistent with their witnesses, and who was telling the truth about what happened on August 25th. And that was my client. And we asked the court to continue the order in this matter. She's met her burden, and we ask the court to continue to afford her the protection in the law that is allowed for a person in her circumstances. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I'm going to read the applicable law again. I did that on replay certain portions of testimony from yesterday's hearing. I can do that in chambers. I'll also review the exhibits that were received yesterday after having heard closing argument. I may have a full docket tomorrow and preparation for that. I hope to have a decision by the end of business on Monday. The stalking order remains in place until there's a decision to dismiss it. And whether the stalking order continues or whether it's dismissed, I hope to have a decision by the end of business again, by the end of business on Monday. I'll send a letter to the attorneys stating whether the stalking order is continued or whether it's dismissed. If you don't receive a letter by the end of business on Monday, it means that something unexpected has come up. But I'll be working on your case diligently and hope to have a decision for you by that time. That'll conclude today's hearing. Thank you.
Yeah.
What's up?